Welcome to the Practical Enneagram. Andrew Hahn is the founder of Life Centered Therapy. A clinical psychologist, he's been studying the Enneagram since 1991 and teaching it since 1993. He is the developer of something called the Essence Process, a way of working with the energetics of our Enneagram patterns as a pathway to spiritual transformation or as a pathway to essence. Andy has been very specific about how the energetics of our personality patterns manifest, and his teaching around it is quite distinct. I want to say thank you to my friend and other Enneagram teacher Ingrid for pointing me in the direction of Andy's work. It would be a good idea to read the articles that I've linked to in the episode notes in order to get a handle on the content of this interview. To introduce it, I'd like to read a poem that Andy wrote about this essence work. It's called Falling into Grace. Falling into Grace. What I want to know is, when you fall down, how do you respond? Do you pretend you have not fallen? And if you do, do you deny the grace that is your place when you fall? Do you experience just how small you really are? Or deny the very essence of that truth, and in that act, deny yourself and not tend to your garden? What I want to know is, when you fall down, how do you respond? Do you frown, not knowing that you've grown? Do you groan at the naked pain and curse the gods as a refrain? Or do you refrain from wallowing in the pain, experiencing exquisite pain, a labour leading to creative birth? So that's the poem. I hope that you enjoy this conversation with Andy. Can you say how the Enneagram came into your life and work? I'm imagining you were well into your practice as a clinical psychologist. I'd love to know what the encounter was like, how you experienced it when you did.
I can totally tell you that. I remember it really well. I had a roommate whose name was Terry, and Terry loved the Enneagram. And she said, not only do you have to study the Enneagram, you have to do it with this particular teacher named Barbara Hastings, who she thought was the best teacher of the Enneagram ever. And Barbara would come to Boston like 4 times a year. And every time Barbara would come, Terry would say, you have to go. Terry said, Barbara never offers discounts. So I said, Terry, you get me a discount and I'll go to the workshop. I thought that would shut Terry up. And Terry said, I actually worked for Barbara, so I'm going to call in a gift. Barbara gave a discount to me, and then I was stuck. So I had to go to the workshop at that point because I got the discount, which, by the way, I never took. And I went to it. I knew nothing about the Enneagram. I'd studied a little bit when Terry told me about it in 1990, but I didn't know much about it. And I get there, and Barbara would go, she would go 3, 6, 9, 1, 4, 2, 8, 5, 7. So the first person, and there were about 50 people at this place. And in the first one was a person who thought he was a three. And he gets up there, he's speaking like a lot of the things that a three would say, but you can tell he doesn't belong there. And after about 10 minutes, she says, you know, you may want to try a different panel, like seven. So that was very interesting. And you could tell these people all belong together. And it was like, I said, oh my God, this is fascinating. Because I knew people were different, but I had never had a framework for understanding the difference. So I get up there on the four panel, and there are seven of us, right? There's seven, six women and me. And our surface stories could not be more different. There was a hairdresser, an accountant, but she said she made the most beautiful tax returns anyone ever made. So there are seven of us, and like, they're telling their stories, and I'm saying, the surface is different, but our stories are the same. I start telling my story of my life, and I see all these six women nodding their heads like this. And of course I said, well, you know, that's interesting, because I always thought I was different from everybody. And here's a group of people who all think, so we're all the same. We all think we're different. And it was fascinating. And when eventually, when that man who was a three, quote unquote, got on the seven panel, you could tell he was at home. And I said, oh my God. And I get goosebumps. I can still feel it now, 30 years later. I could see how remarkable it was. So I get fascinated by it. And Barbara kept coming back. So I went to 12 introductory workshops. And every time I would learn something different. And then I started teaching with her. And that was my introduction to the Enneagram. Mm-hmm. And then I started teaching on my own. And I ran this group. 20 people came to the group. I had them each bring something that was sacred to them. This was 1994 into 95. And it was fascinating. People brought things that were very funny. And some people brought things that were very sacred. And I did an introduction in 9 sessions. And then after that, one of the people who was there, who was a three, whose name was Cynthia, I said, would you guys like to keep going? And she says, I'll keep going on one condition, which is you teach us how to use this the Enneagram is a spiritually transformative tool. Well, you know, we're fours. Fools go in where angels fear to tread. So I said, fine, come back in two weeks and I'll teach you how to use the Enneagram as a spiritually transformative tool. And I had no idea. All I knew was that people like Helen and Claudio said that the way to essence is through the personality. I didn't know what that meant. I wanted to ask Helen what that meant, and because I got to know Helen pretty well later when I actually did this process with her. But she said that, and I said, well, what does that mean? And she just sort of gave a knowing smile, like, someday you'll understand, which didn't help very much. So I'm there, and I've studied, like, at this point, a lot of psychology. I mean, voice dialogues and spiritual psychology and a lot of different things. I had no clue. So the thing goes on Tuesday night. Since it's a Sunday, if I don't know it now, I'm in big trouble. And I'm in my favorite position, which is like lying on my couch half asleep. And this idea comes to me about how you use the Enneagram as a spiritually transformative tool, which was like, oh my gosh, that's so obvious. And it just came to me sort of in this half awake state and made sense. I mean, I think it's one of those things, if you study things long enough, life gives you a gift. So I'm there and I say, oh, well, how do you do it? Well, you'd have to be able to accept the thing that you were most afraid or ashamed to accept about yourself. Because if you could accept that, you could accept everything. That's what came to me. I was already doing somatic and mindfulness psychology. So I'd say the way you would do it would be, you would say it's an experience you're having, which you can experience somatically as a body sensation. And you could bring all your attention to this thing that you were most afraid to experience about yourself, which would have a form of a trauma, because anything you can't handle has a form of a trauma, which means there'll be a body sensation that is the equivalent of it. And then you could just bring all your attention to it, at which point you wouldn't be it. You'd be the one who was witnessing it. And then it would be just like anything else. I said, that's interesting. So that's just an experience. And it's from the point of view of the witness that's choosing it and holding it. It's not who it is. It's outside of it. So then I said, well, you literally can externalize it and witness it outside of you and see that it's in a space. And the space is just goes in every direction, and it's boundaryless, dimensionless, infinitely expanding spaciousness. It's just the fullness of the emptiness. But of course, you can't become that if there's anything you won't say yes to. But as soon as you say yes to the thing that you're most afraid to admit about yourself, then you could say yes theoretically to anything. So I just had people, what I said was, we're going to do that and we're going to expand. So you become the everything, so that this is part of it's part of the everything, but it's obviously not who you are. It's just an experience you're having, but it has to be the most powerful experience you can have, because it's the one that you spend the most time trying to get away from. The thing that we're most afraid to admit about ourselves is either the doorway to the divine or is the divine itself, depending on how you understand it. I mean, our core fears, I mean, however you want to understand the core fear of the four, which is, you know, I'm ordinary and therefore defective and something's wrong with me and I'd rather be dead than have to experience that, right? So it keeps saying to me, you think you get away from me? I'm bigger than you are. And you can try to do anything you want to get people to think you're special. And at the end of the day, you'll be by yourself and I'll knock on the door and say, I will always be here. And, you know, you can curse me, you can deny me, you can hate me, you can pretend I don't exist, but I'm still here. And I promise you, I will always be with you. What you have to then do is you have to ask this thing that has been the thing that you've been most afraid to admit about yourself, what its greatest hope for you is. And you could actually dialogue with it, but not to think that it's your worst enemy, but your greatest friend and teacher. So that came to me on Sunday, and I did it the next day. I'm a clinician and I use kinesiology, and it said to use this process with a man who came in for the first time and said he was suicidal. And he was a one, very clearly, and his boyfriend of 16 years had just broken up with him. And he said, I'm not going to kill myself, but I feel really suicidal. So I said, great. So what you're going to do is, why don't you find the thing that you're most afraid to admit about yourself? Right. Well, he starts with, I'm so bad. And I say, is there anything worse than that? And I'm dialoguing now with a sensation. I had him feel badness in his body. And he finally gets to, I'm so bad that I belong in hell, except for the fact that there are other people in hell. So it can't be that I belong in hell because I'm worse than them. And he's crying rather hysterically. And I said, I think that's about it. So then I said to him, I want you to just notice something. If you can witness that as a body sensation, it can't be who you are. It's just an experience you're having. It's not who you are. It's just an experience you're having like any other experience. And then I had him externalize the experience, the sensation, and me expand. And he becomes everything. At that point, dialogues with this thing. And it says, all I ever wanted you to know was that you're perfect just the way you are. He has this look on his face and he says, I have felt this way once before in my life. I never thought I would feel it again, because he said, I'm an artist. And he said, I painted one painting that I thought was perfect. And I had this experience, the one moment I thought I'd never have it again. I'm having it right now. Yeah. And then I knew I was onto something. So then I went back to my group on Tuesday, because this was Monday. And I said, I think I know a way to teach you about the Enneagram as a spiritually transformative tool. Mm-hmm. And points of every kind. I explained it to them. And then we went through each of points, went through the process, and everybody talked about what it was like. And that was the beginning of how I started doing the essence work 27 years ago. And I've been teaching it ever since. And I've been teaching that process all over the world. I taught at the first IEA conference.
Do you describe this? This is a somatic approach to working with our Enneagram structures, is it? Is that how you would describe it?
I describe it as somatic, this part of it, because every time there's something you can't handle, in that moment, a sensation is born. Right. So I would say it's not a part of us. It's a living being. People think it's a part. So usually what they do is they mediate it through mind. They say something like, if this could talk, what would it say? Or they say something, if someone says, I feel sick to my stomach, and they say, okay, sick to your stomach. But it's not sick to my stomach any more than your name isn't sick to my, it isn't my res, it's res. And its name is sick to stomach. It's not sick to my stomach. It's sick to stomach, and it's come to share something. It just happens that most things like this are living beings, like human beings or animals or extraterrestrials or whatever. This living being is just an aspect of soul, and it's an aspect of soul that we call by the wrong name. But because it's soul, it still has form, and because it has form, it can become dense like anything else. And you know, so we call this wrongly, from our point of view, it's a soul level trauma. It's about the mistaken notion that we truly are, which is everything is non-existence from the point of view of duality. So, of course, we spend our whole life trying not to be who we truly are. So we experience it as a very dense energy, as a black hole. And if you can choose to become the black hole and do something counterintuitive and say, okay, instead of running from you, I will just face you and let myself go into you, worlds open up to us.
You map the energetics of the subtype layer, the centers, and then the points of view. So does it go that we become aware of points of view, core fears, and centers, and energetics around the centers, and then subtypes? So is it in layers?
No, it's more gestalt-like. Like, I'm a sexual four, right? Mm. Well, I could tell you forever, what is the thing that is worst for me? Mm. Disconnection. I long for connection. You know, I'm locked into you. I don't know if you're a sexual subtype or not.
Self-pres.
I was going to say you felt a little self-presy. Anyway, but I know I'm highly sexual first and I'm social second, and self-pres barely exists. But I know that when I feel a sense of disconnection from something outside, I hit inner disconnection. And I've been doing that since I've been a little kid. It's why I go into major depressions. I don't go into major depressions because of my fourness. Like, I could do the most shameful thing, and if you say, Andy, you're okay, and I'll be here with you, and I'm not going anyplace, I won't go into a major depression. But if you abandon me for whatever reason, or I lose home or whatever, I go into major depressions. And I've been doing that since I was homesick when I was, you know, 9 years old and I went off to overnight camp. So I would say it's not linear in that you start with your point and then you find your center and then you find your subtype. I would say that subtype is the deepest of all of the core fears, because it's so intrinsic for our ancestors about survival, right? Yeah. So from an instinctual point of view, it's like, it's bad to be ordinary, but it's worse to like not have a connection and die. Right. Mm. So I would say they're the most visceral, but center is also really visceral too. If you're a belly point, right?
Yeah.
And you spend all your life pulsively being responsible. Why? Because you don't know your heart's desire, really. Mm. It's not that you don't know what you're feeling. A lot of belly points will know what they're feeling, but if you say to them, forget responsibility, I think belly points say essentially, I sense and do, therefore I am. I think us, we say, I feel, therefore I am. And head points say, I think, therefore I am. Well, why do we compulsively do this? Why do we elevate one of these experiences? It's because we don't want to experience something else. So if I'm responsible, if I'm self-forgetting, what does self-forgetting mean? It means I don't know my heart. That's why I say it's a very funny thing for belly points, because they're not embodied. We say the energy goes up and diffuse, and they say, what the hell are you talking about? I'm so in my body. And I say, really? So what being in your body means, you know what you really desire. Mm-hmm. And I started doing this. I did this with an eight, you know, and she said, I know exactly what I want. I said, really? You know exactly what you want? Tell me about it. And she said, I can do anything I want. I can have anything I want. I wanted to be this. I was this. I wanted to be this. I was this. I said, did you really want to be that? Or did you just know you could do it because you were so competent and hierarchically you knew what was going on? She said, you don't get it. I can do anything I want. I said, really? Tell me that you really like the soft heart, really wanted to do this. And then finally she broke down hysterically crying, and people looked at her because she never cried. She said, I've never had a clue about what I really desire.
Mm, yeah.
So of course, You know, that's a very powerful motive. But I still think it's probably not as powerful as, you know, if I don't connect with you, I'll die.
A gestalt, more of a gestalt than a linear process. That does make sense. When is anything linear in this area? Can we describe the energetics of the subtypes and the centers? Can you go through them with me now, like you did with the body types, up, out, and diffuse?
I think sexual subtypes, we say they lose their true center, which is down and in one of three directions, right? Forward and out, back and in, or up and diffuse. Mm-hmm. So if you're, you know, a sexual subtype, and for me, what a sexual subtype means is that there is craving for a deep erotic connection. So I think a mother who is gazing at their child and they've locked eyes and the rest of the world goes away, I think that's sexual subtype. So I don't think it's just about attracting a sexual partner. I think that doesn't make sense to me. So just so you can know, because I talk about these things and a lot of people say, no, it's biological instincts. I say, no, it's an energetic. And the biological instincts, which are matter, have to come out of energy. It's not that energy comes out of matter. That's why I think that the energetics are fundamental. Yeah. What's the energetics of a sexual subtype? It means that I lose myself forward and out. I desperately want to connect with you. If I don't connect with you, I go into a sense that we call inner disconnection. You know, the deep fear of inner disconnection, which I think is what drives every sexual subtype. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I lose myself forward and out because I have to connect with the other, whatever that is, whether it's a lover or a baby or a piece of work or whatever it is, as long as I can do it. So you can feel the energetic of it. I have to go this way, right? And if I'm self-preserving, the first energetic has to be something where it goes back and in. It's an incorporative process. If you talk to a self-preserving type, what they'll say to you is, and it's very interesting when you have them on panels, they essentially say, in order for me to do anything else, the first thing I have to do is take something in, which is why you get these self-preserving panels and no one talks first, because they're all waiting to take something in. I mean, unless they're talking about, you know, the weather or something. If I'm with a self-preserving type and I'm not energetically mindful and I come forward, they'll go away very fast and they'll say, you're too much, you're too intense, you're too whatever, because, you know, what they're taking in is dangerous. And social, when I say it's up and diffuse, it's like there's this sense of, if we talk about it the way Helen talks about it, like, you know, at a party, it's like being at a cocktail party. You know, the energy goes this way. It doesn't laser in, right? Yeah. And it doesn't go back. It just goes diffuse. It goes up and diffuse. It takes everything in. And so those are the three energetics of it. Because people don't know that, they have all kinds of judgment. I mean, you think about people in relationship, right? If you're at a party and you're a sexual subtype, you're going to want to find the most interesting person and laser in on them and do whatever. And the social subtype will come over being social and you won't pay any attention to them. You'll say hi and then you go back and they'll think you're rude. Yeah. And, you know, in a social subtype, everybody's there. And, you know, the sexual subtype will feel like everybody here, no one's being intense and deep. And there'll be all these judgments that are going on because they don't recognize that it's just different energetics. It's why, you know, if I'm a social subtype and I'm going to propose to you, I'm going to do it in front of 20,000 people at a baseball game where I get down on my knees and say, and, you know, where I'm with all my friends and they're taking pictures. Now, of course, I would rather be dead than propose to somebody that way. But, you know, and if you're self-preserving sexual, you'll feel the same way. But if you're social, you'll, of course, want to incorporate your clan into the thing because that's saying, I love you. I brought all these people together and, you know, we're all going to have a big party because I'm taking you into the group. All right, let's go to centers now for a second, right? So I'm a heart center person, right? Well, what do I want? What do I want and why do I want it? Now, I think the core emotion is despair for heart types. I don't think it's grief because I think grief is something that is for everyone. Grief is like what I think is healing. So I don't think it can be grief. I don't think it's sadness either. I mean, it should be sadness because if you have fear and anger, it should be sadness, but it's not. I think why I say it's despair is that there's a longing, a craving to be approved of and liked, right? Which is not about sadness because if I'm a heart point and you just like say, really? I'll feel despair. So I have to do everything I can not to feel it. So I'm going to have to find some way to be something that you're going to accept. So of course, my energy is going to go forward and out. I have to get your acceptance. I'm going to do it in three different ways. And those are three different energetics. If I'm a giver, of course, I'm going to laser out to the particular other. And I'm going to like say, what do you need me to be? So they will go forward and out and forward and out, right? And if they're sexual, they'll go forward and out and forward and out and forward and out. But if you're a heart point, any heart point has to go forward and out because I have to get your acceptance in order to be acceptable. So I don't feel this despair about that I'm unlovable unless I create some kind of image, even if I'm a four, because we create images also. But we all go forward and out because we have to get the acceptance and the approval and the liking of the other. If I'm a head point, I have to go back and in because the world is a dangerous place. And it's just, and it doesn't matter if I'm a five, six, or seven, the world's dangerous. All head points, their first move is going to be to go back and in, away from something that's dangerous to them. Mm-hmm. And every belly point, it's going to be their move is up and diffuse. And why I say that is, it's like you talk to any belly point and you say to them, if you weren't being responsible, and we're going to take that out of your vocabulary, mm-hmm. you're not going to send something and then take an action. You're going to have to take an action independently. And it's going to be what you really desire. Or, you know, Helen tells us this story. It was one of the first stories she ever told about nines. She said, there was an interior decorator. He said, give me anybody's house and I can make it perfect in 4 days for them. You know, I can just tune into them. I've been working in my own room for 14 years. I still don't have a clue what I want. So that's when I say the energy is up and diffuse, it's like, if you don't know your desire, you're not embodied. Mm-hmm. Even though, of course, your perceptual mode is through the belly, but all that means is that you perceive through the belly, you know, you can know viscerally who has the control. You can know viscerally if there's peace or disharmony. You can know viscerally if something is wrong or right, but it doesn't tell you anything about what your heart's desire is. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, the core fears that you identified for each triad, I have not seen that anywhere else. You know, the core fear of the heart center is,
I am no head.
Yeah, I am no head. It really resonated. How did you land on those core fears?
It was simple because if you think about what it is that you don't have, right? What does a belly point not have? They don't know their heart's desire. It's I am no heart. Mm-hmm. And so their sense, their compulsiveness to be sensing and doing or be responsible is a way to bind the anxiety around I have no idea what my true heart's desire is. They elevate sensing and doing as a way to bind the anxiety of not knowing what they truly desire, right? Mm-hmm. And as a heart point, my core fear is I'm no head. So I compulsively have to say, I feel, therefore I am. But really what that is a way of not experiencing my no headness. Now, how do we know we're no head? Because when we want someone to approve of us, we do very dumb things, very undiscerning things. Mm-hmm. But really what I'd say is that's what's fundamental is we don't believe we have a head. Mm-hmm. So we elevate feeling as a way not to experience no headness. It's the elevation of feeling is a way to bind the anxiety of feeling like there's a black hole in the head that really is about our lack of discernment. And so, of course, just to go further, what do you have to do if you want to be free of that is you have to experience the thing that you're most afraid to experience, right? Mm. Joni, my partner in this, people would always ask her everything. And she would always do everything. She would always do the Thanksgiving for her family. One day she said, why am I doing this? I don't even want to do it. So they said, okay, so what's happening for Thanksgiving? She said, I don't know. She said it was the hardest thing she ever had to do was she said, what I realized, I didn't know what I wanted, but I realized what I didn't want, which was to do one more Thanksgiving where I was the one who took care of everything and did it confidently and everybody brought a small dish. So she said, I'm just not going to do it. She said, this was so hard. I mean, you know, make her the controller of the international division of Pfizer at age 25. She said, that was easy. I could do that easily. Wow. But like saying to my whole family, I don't know what we're doing for Thanksgiving. Mm. She said, that was way harder than anything else I did that was responsible.
And that's a body type.
Yeah, she's an eight. Mm. You know, my role in life is to be the one who's responsible and I'm the most competent one. Why don't I just like throw all of that away in one fell swoop and just say, I don't know what we're going to do. And like, you guys will do whatever you want. And, you know, you can come use the house if you like, but I'm not going to do anything. And she said, pure unadulterated terror.
And the head anyway. Center, the core fear of the head center.
I am no body.
I am no body.
I am no body. And every head center feels that way. That's why and it's all energetic. That's why I think all the core fears of head centers are energetic core fears. I am insufficient is what we think the core fear of the five. Mm. I get all these core fears because I've done this essence process and I keep asking people, what are you most afraid to experience about yourself? And, you know, that's how I came up with all of these things. You know, I didn't come up with them. I just asked people, you know, what are you most afraid to experience? I mean, I had the six and, you know, we're dancing around all these things about six. And finally, I say to two sixes in a row, we go through this process. And when two of them in a row said, I am a nobody, and it's so humiliating. And One of them was totally counterphobic and one of them was totally phobic. And they both had the same fear, which is I am a nobody. And it's humiliating. One of them, because he was afraid he was a 90-pound weakling, became an amazing, you know, martial arts instructor. And anyone who looked at him funny would just like wipe them out. And the other one cowered like crazy. But they both said the same thing. And I said, OK, I got it. How humiliating it is to be a nobody. Mm-hmm. And seven, unfulfillable. You know, the glass is half full, but why does a seven not want pain or want boredom? Because literally they're filling themselves up with this thing. So it's who they are. Mm-hmm. They can't sit with it. It becomes an expression of who they are because there's a kind of no-bodiness to all of those points. All of them say, I am not a nobody. I am no body. And mm-hmm. so you have to then, if you want to be free of that, there's only one way, which is to experience I am no body over and over and over again as a spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. And the spiritual practice I do for myself is I do spiritual practices on the core fears. Okay. I feel them in my body. And
that, yeah, that's what I was about to ask. Can you describe how that looks?
Really, it's very easy to describe. Mm. To do it ongoingly and to notice it ongoingly is tricky. But the way I do it is I just really let myself, if I'm looking at the point of four, right? Mm-hmm. All I do is I just feel this thing that I would call I'm ordinary, therefore I'm defective, therefore, you know, something is wrong with me, therefore, no, I will be unacceptable, all of those things. And I feel that in my body and I sit with it. And I feel, I can feel it right now. I get,
can you
just try it? You'll feel sick to your stomach. I feel sick to my stomach. Then I bring all my attention to sick to stomach, which is the equivalent of those things. And I just say, okay, I'm here with you. Mm-hmm. And I just do it over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. That's my simple practice. Or it's the same thing with disconnection. I know what it's like to feel profound disconnection. Like I'm just this empty husk. If I don't connect with you, there's just nothing inside except for blackness. I know what that feels like. I can remember. Mm-hmm. So I just sit with it. I choose to sit with, you know, the sense of total inner disconnection where there's nobody home, like zero. Feel that in my body. And I feel that now slightly different sensation. I say, okay, I'm going to bring all my attention there and just be with whatever arises. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with no head, which I know, believe me, very well. I'm not going to tell stories, but I...
You know it well. I remember reading an excerpt, actually, that it just really struck me. What was it? How I lose my head and make oblivious decisions because I want the approval of others. You know what I was thinking when I read that? I know conceptually all of those things are my things too. And yet I find myself getting the less authentic, I think, versions of them. So I feel restless and I feel hunger or I feel boredom, you know?
When you start with whatever's there, when I originally started, people tell me external things like that all the time. They'd say, well, I'm bored. So then I'd say, feel restless or bored in the body, which you'll feel as a discomfort of some kind, an agitated feeling or a heavy feeling or a empty feeling or whatever. And I'd say, okay, choose to bring all your attention to it from the inside out. And then we're going to say, at some point or other, it will shift to I'm boring, not I'm bored. That's what happens with sevens, right? It's just a process of, because the question is, you're talking now to the energetic and you're saying to the energetic, I'm no longer talking to res, I'm talking to heavy feeling or empty feeling. I'm saying, what are you most afraid to admit about yourself? And it will go from I'm bored to I'm boring, to I'm boring because of some sense of lack in myself, and I'll never not be boring. And no matter what I do to try to get, you know, to take care of boring by filling myself up with all these experiences, I'll never be filled up, which is how I got to the seven of I'm unfulfillable.
Yeah.
Because sevens kept saying, I'll never be filled up. I'll never be filled up. That's who I am. I'm someone who will never be filled up. I got it. I said, okay, you've taught me. You're unfulfillable. No matter what you do, that's what you're afraid to experience. So you're going to keep filling yourself up compulsively over and over and over again, hoping you'll be filled up, but it never happens because it doesn't take care of I'm unfulfillable. What really makes me nuts is when people think a core fear is something external, like I'll be rejected. That can't be a core fear. It's what is it about you that means that people will reject you? Well, we all are afraid of rejection, but says nothing about your internal state.
But just curious to know your perspective on integrating this essence work in a coaching practice.
I coach people all the time.
Oh, you do? This is a wise integration, so we can work on the energetics in a coaching practice.
Coaching for me is three things. Mm-hmm. It's understanding, it's releasing blocks, and it's manifesting what you desire. all of which, by the way, are energetics. But if you're going to use the essence process around it, you'd have to say, well, where are you stuck so that you can't manifest what you desire? You'd have to find out what you compulsively do and what fear it covers over. And then if you could, you know, work with that with somebody, which I would work with in the way I told you, they get freer, right? And when you get freer, then you're not, you don't compulsively do anything. And then you can truly use what's called the law of attraction, but in a different way, because there's nothing blocking it. It gets a little tricky because sometimes what's blocking, of course, is life trauma and not Enneagram stuff. How I use it in coaching would be, I help you understand. I would help you understand what's going on. I would then help you find out what it is that you're compulsively avoiding. And then I'd help you manifest whatever it is that you would want, because nothing would be in the way. And then you can feel in your body what it is that you really want to create, as opposed to just having it in your imagination. I could say, when you really desire whatever you desire, what does that feel like in the body? If it's a good sensation, you drop your attention into the good sensation, right? Because I'm somatic. And they'll feel an effervescent feeling or a lighthearted feeling or an expansive feeling. I'll say, just bring all your awareness there and choose to become it and let it teach you what you really desire, because what you thought you desire was a doorway in, but it knows better than you.
Thank you. Hello again. My next interviewee is Vanessa Fernandez, who runs the Enneagram Workshop. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the podcast.